Down to Dunk Podcast.
Welcome to the Down to Dunk Podcast. This is Andrew, and I'm joined today by Steve McPherson. He's a Renaissance man who does a lot of things. He writes for Grantland, A Wolf Among Wolves, Harvard Paroxysm, New York Times, and has about 100 other jobs that he's told me about. Steve, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well, Andrew.
So you wrote this piece for Grantland about kind of pop culture and NBA names, kind of feeding off the Raptors name and what teams would be named if they were named in their present time. So the one that terrified me the most was the Pelicans, which are the selfies. Those jerseys are absolutely terrifying and also very awesome. I really enjoyed the piece. And, you know, the Thunder is a name that has been extremely recent. And kind of, I know that most of what you did was a joke, and it was a really funny article, and you should go check it out if you haven't. But what do you think about the Thunder name? And if you could change the name, would you? And what would it be? I know this is kind of off the top of your head stuff, but what do you think about the Thunder name?
I think the Thunder name isn't bad. I think it's not terrific. But I think that a lot of the names that are terrific are often so – it's such a small slice of who finds that hilarious that they're sort of unworkable in a lot of ways for something as broad as a sports team. You know, so the Thunder is not, you know, there were some other ones that were considered that I thought were good. It was like Buffalo or Bison or something considered as one of them.
Yeah, the Bison was up there.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I like the animal thing. Mm-hmm. The Thunder, you know, the collective noun thing is okay. I think I have more of a problem with OKC's jerseys than really the name itself, because I think you could do cool things with that name. I think the jerseys themselves are kind of just okay. They seem less generic than they did at first, but mm-hmm. that's just – I mean, the weird thing about something as big as a sports team name, and the same thing comes up with rock bands, I think, is that, you know, you hear it and you think something about it, but as it sort of exists over time, that it sort of begins to disappear. You stop thinking so much about the name, and you think more about everything else, and mm-hmm. The team becomes – the players on the team become emblematic of that name. So if it was the Oklahoma City Thunder and you didn't have Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook and, you know, these players who are sort of defining the franchise, you might think less of that name, you know, because you wouldn't have great players. So, you know, it's like the Beatles is a terrible name, but it's the Beatles. So yeah. So you're okay with it. You know, like there's a couple ones like New Orleans, one of the suggestions, I think, early on was Rougarou, which is a Louisiana swamp werewolf from Cajun mythology.
Yeah.
I believe it comes from Lou Garou, L-O-U-P, like wolf in French, and then Garou is like something like monstrous or something like that. So, like, I thought Rougarou was awesome, you know? Or like, you know, I even had a discussion with, I don't know if you know Bourbon Street Shots, who's I believe they're the Pelicans, new website that's under the True Hoop Network. And,
okay, yeah.
The first suggestion for rebranding, like they wanted to rebrand them as something New Orleans when they switched to the Pelicans, was a confederacy of dunks, which is a joke on a confederacy of dunces, which is a famous New Orleans book by, I think, John Kennedy O'Toole. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, that's brilliant. That's awesome. You have to do that. But then people started bringing up the thing of like, it's very difficult to name anything a confederacy of anything when you're in the South, because it has all these associations with it. You know, like you had to picture those people going up to players, you know, in a predominantly black league and saying, I'm from a confederacy of something. And it's a joke about a book that you might not know, you know,
yeah.
But it was like one of those things where I was like, it's so good. You have to do it. But again, it's like, it's so specific. So anything that's like as funky and fun as I would want it to be is probably too funky for general consumption. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, so like the Thunder, it's like, it's not bad. It's not terrific, which means it's fine for sports, I think.
Yeah. And you know what? I never thought about it that way, that, you know, no one talks about the Thunder name being good or bad. There's the Oklahoma City Thunder because we have Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and our team is awesome.
Right.
But the Bobcats is a name that people talk about all the time as being terrible, and it's a bad name.
Yeah.
But it's even worse because the team has been so bad ever since they've, you know, been the Bobcats. And I think that's a more of a, do you think that's more of a talking point because the team is bad?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the Bobcats thing, I mean, the Bobcats does have that underlying thing about how there was that, the fan vote for whatever, and whatever won, now I'm forgetting what it was. I know I talked about it in the article, the flight or something like that, I think it was, got overruled by the owner whose name is Bob.
Right.
And you're kind of like, well, that seems kind of, you know, like, I think that element of it, an element like that becomes emblematic of the problems with that franchise, right? Because it's attached to the fact that the original owner named it this over the wishes of the public because it's kind of, you know, self-aggrandizing. And then he's gone now, like he's sold it, and they're still called the Bobcats. So that whole thing comes to sort of, you know, there's these things about teams where there's sort of this self-fulfilling prophecy about it. Like, I remember, it's sort of unrelated, but I remember before I was really involved, before I was at all involved in writing about basketball, I remember the Wolves drafting Corey Brewer, when the Wolves picked Corey Brewer. Mm-hmm. And, I was looking at draft boards going into that draft, and I remember John Hollinger had a thing where he's, like, evaluating people based on, you know, how they're going to bear out in the NBA. And they're like, everybody's pretty much well-positioned, except Corey Brewer is going to be terrible in the NBA. he's riding basically on how good his performance was in college, you know, and being a national champion and everything like that. But it's just like he doesn't project out to be a good NBA player. But a lot of people were like, Corey Brewer is going to be great. And I wasn't sure. I was kind of on the fence. And then when the Wolves picked him, I was like, well, he's clearly going to be awful because the Wolves pick him and they don't know how to draft. And, you know, obviously, and Brewer's gone on to have like a very solid career and come back to the Wolves, and he's done a lot of good things for the Wolves. Bad things as well at times this season, but you know, he's turned into a solid NBA player, but he certainly was not like a top 10 pick in his first couple years in the league when he was with the Wolves. So it's kind of that thing of like, you just expect the worst. It's sort of like in the Bobcats, it's kind of the same thing. Like, mm-hmm. I think that name has come to be attached to, you're just going to get the worst out of this team. So I mean, I'm excited for them to go back to the Hornets. I think their new logo looks really awesome.
Yes.
I think that that's a positive change. Although I did like, my favorite thing about the Bobcats was a couple of years ago, somebody suggested because of New Orleans, you know, changing their name eventually when they were the Hornets, that they should just take Utah and New Orleans and Charlotte and just rotate the names one turn so that Utah goes to being the Bobcats and Charlotte goes to being the Hornets and New Orleans goes back to being the Jazz. Like, you would just move all the mascots one spot around the circle and you would end up with names that all made more sense because there are Bobcats in Utah, and there's Jazz and New Orleans, and the Hornets is the original Charlotte franchise.
So. It makes total sense. I think Utah fans might be upset about that, though.
Yeah, probably.
Even though Jazz makes no sense, it's so much cooler than the Bobcats. Yeah.
Well, and now I hate to take it away because the Jazz have done... I mean, I still think the Utah Jazz thing is weird, but they've done such a good job with their branding. Like, their uniforms look great. I love their sort of throwback old-school uniforms and everything. I was never a fan of the Jazz growing up, but I definitely sort of come around on the way that franchise is being handled, I think. So.
Yeah, and it's especially hard to change anything when a franchise has actually had success. Like the Bobcats, yeah, you can change it. And the Hornets, you know, they didn't really have any success in New Orleans, so it was okay to change. But,
yeah,
it's hard to change it when you had Karl Malone and John Stockton there for years and years.
Yeah, well, somebody brought that up to me on Twitter where they were saying, you know, how the Lakers, and you can't change the Lakers because they've had success. And it's true. It's like at this point, I mean, the Lakers makes no sense. It maybe makes almost the least sense if it's not for the Jazz. Mm-hmm. There's no way you're changing the Los Angeles Lakers. I mean, it's alliterative, and it's just, you can't change that at this point. So some teams are just kind of stuck with where they are. I mean, I guess the Raptors considered changing a year ago or so, mm-hmm. And possibly looking at things like the Huskies, which was one of the original possibilities for the name.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the Raptors have a mixed heritage in that way, I guess. You know, they've had Vince Carter, but also their own problems. And the Raptors name still just endures as, like, it's such a weird thing to have a franchise called that. So,
yeah, it's just I don't know. It is unusual and imaginary and kind of fun, though.
It could be a lot worse, definitely. So
I like their old jerseys that actually had a Raptor on it.
like the pinstripe ones. Those were like the early ones. Those were, it's funny how all those jerseys that like at the time I thought were so bad, now they look kind of fun. Like the Bucks one that was like sort of an airbrushed stag, you know, or like, or sort of ones that were like, it's funny how some things that are like legendarily sort of in bad taste, like not even in basketball, but in sports. I remember the Astros having those like rainbow jerseys. It was like, like at the time you're like, that's disgusting. Now you're like, those are cool. Like,
Nuggets jerseys the blue rainbow Nuggets jerseys.
Oh yeah, totally. I was like that. Or the Spurs. I remember very distinctly the Spurs haven't really called back to it, but they had that time where they had the sort of pink, turquoise, gold in there. And I was like, that's a really horrible color combo. Like, it's just such a weird kind of Southwest, but not really thing. And now I see that, I'm like, that's kind of cool. I would go for that. So, it's just the league took such a turn towards like genericness, I think, that it's almost a reaction to it. Like, you look at the Hawks jerseys specifically, are ones that, I mean, they're not terrible, but it's like compared to what you had in the Dominique era, you know, like it was just had so much more color and life. Like, the sort of like, hey, navy blue and red. And it just seems kind of, it just doesn't seem great. So I think some of the flashier stuff seems much more fun. Whereas when it was in an era when flashiness was the norm, it felt kind of over the top. So
Definitely. Well, let's switch gears. We're going to talk about the Caron Butler signing. He was signed by the Thunder, and he had some pretty good interviews yesterday. What are your thoughts on that signing? And do you think that there's a buyout guy that'll have a bigger impact on the playoffs?
I mean, it's going to depend a lot. I think that Cephalosha's injury is really opening the door, for Butler to step in and do something with the team. I mean, I certainly, that lineup with Perry Jones starting at shooting guard, I was like, okay, sure. Yeah. Which obviously he didn't play. I mean, I didn't get to watch the game, but I read some recaps and was looking at the box score and stuff like that. And he didn't seem like he played a lot of time in shooting guard. It's interesting. I think Butler is. I think he could make a big impact on the playoffs. Certainly on a team that's going to make a lot of noise in the playoffs. Other candidates like Danny Granger, who's on the Clippers now, right? He signed with the Clippers. I feel out of it because I was at the Sloan Sports Conference all this past weekend. So I was like talking a lot about basketball, but I didn't get to like follow a lot of basketball. So it seems like Granger is like, as people are like, oh, like he was in Indiana and they were like, oh, he's done. He's not going to be any good. Then he gets released and every team is like, hey, he's a former All-Star, And I don't know how much of that he has, but Butler is like still a productive player. I've always liked Caron Butler's game. And I think that the whole, his whole tough juice persona is one of those guys where he can bring a lot to any team that's looking to kind of, fortify themselves. And so I think he can be helpful. I mean, I think what you hope for is that he's any guy like this. It never happened with Tracy McGrady last year. But the Thunder have a guy in Derek Fisher, who's kind of one of those guys where you don't need him to be like great all the time. You just need like in some situation, in some game in the playoffs, for him to like suddenly have a great game that holds off, a loss that would be really damaging. Mm-hmm. And I think that Caron is the kind of guy who could probably do that for a team. So hopefully he can do it, for the Thunder. Like, I don't think it means he's going to have consistent production. The same thing, I mean, at the other end of his career, he's at the other end of his career, but a guy like Shabazz Muhammad, like before the season for the Wolves, I was like, he's going to have one game where he's amazing, mm-hmm. At least like one game where he's really great, which he had, last week. Yeah. All of a sudden he got off the bench and he was terrific. And then some people are really quick to be like, well, why didn't he get played more? And I was like, I think both at the beginning of a guy's career and then towards the tail end, you're not talking about somebody where you're looking for, repeatable production. You put him in and if they look good, you ride him. And then if it turns out great, then you look like a genius, Mm-hmm. And so I think, Caron can be like that, or like rookies do that sometimes in the playoffs as well, like step up and have something huge happen to them, or those guys who have a huge game and then they win a big contract, and never live up to it again. So, but I like the Butler signing. I can't really think of another buyout guy who has the potential to make that kind of impact.
So do you think he could be like Shane Battier is for the Heat?
I don't know. I mean, I think it could provide some of the same kind of stuff. I mean, Battier is such an interesting, weird outlier as far as a basketball player. Like, I think there's not as many guys who are so sort of intellectual about the game and have a really clear understanding of what their strengths and weaknesses are. Mm-hmm. As Battier, that doesn't mean that Battier doesn't make stupid plays, but, you know, he knows where to get his shots. And if he's not in the place where he's going to get his shots, unless you're talking about a completely open shot or, you know, the shot clock winding down, like he wants to take corner threes. Like, he knows what to do. And he's not only a defender anymore, but he's really smart with his defense. I don't know if Butler has quite that same, I think sometimes, and I'm, you know, from having seen him play, on TV some, and having seen him play in person some, like, I think he can, the tough juice thing sometimes gets him carried away, you know? And so I don't know if he could be as clinical and helpful the way that Battier is, but I think that would be a good target for him, you know, to really, you know, I think that some guys are just better. It could be better in situations in which their scope is more limited. I mean, I think that, like, I've always sort of wondered that about Reggie Jackson, actually, for the Thunder as a good example, at least for right now in his career, that when Westbrook went down and then the Thunder still looked really good and people are like, well, do they need Westbrook? Like, they've got Reggie Jackson. But it seems like bringing Jackson off the bench to do what he does in these short stints or in like three guard lineups or sort of like unusual situations, I just feel like that taps into what he's good at right now a lot better. I don't think that means that he can't be a good starter in the NBA, but just for right now, like, I think that that role is so important. And I don't mean necessarily position, but, you know, understanding what you're good at and where you can be most effective on a team, and realizing that sometimes that means not playing 35 minutes a game. That means playing 20 minutes a game and being very effective in what you do. Like, that's, once you've got, you need to have stars, you need to have, you know, bedrock foundational guys on a team. But I think that the margins are where a lot of playoffs are won and lost. I mean, just, you know, ask Robert Horry, ask, you know,
Ray Allen.
So Ray Allen. So, you know, so I think it's important to find those guys. It's hard to know who those guys are, but, you know, I think Butler could play a big role in, you know, in a series or two. So,
yeah, we're really excited. I mean, all Thunder fans are super excited about watching him play. And because of Perk being out and Cephalosha being out, I think we're going to get a chance to see a lot of him. And hopefully he lives up to at least partially our expectations, because I think our expectations are kind of through the roof at this point.
Sure.
Butler.
Which is always dangerous, but, you know, what can you do?
Yeah. Like, so you went to the Sloan Conference. Tell me your biggest takeaway from the conference.
I think the biggest overall thing that I took away from it is that I think the sort of advanced stats and analytics – well, first of all, you sort of need to separate advanced stats from analytics in a lot of ways, because advanced stats to me is really using numbers you already have to tell new kinds of stories about players. So PER is an advanced stat. Win shares is an advanced stat. You're not sort of like gathering new information so much as taking what you have and trying to weight things in a way that gives you different ways to evaluate players. That stuff's great. Analytics to me falls more into the category of the sport view stuff, the tracking, spatial stuff, where you're really looking at the game as it's happening on the floor and then trying to learn things from that. I think that analytics is we're kind of in a trough, a natural trough that follows sort of the first things happening in this, and then sort of immediately it showed us a bunch of new things. And it continues to sort of provide some of that information. If you think back to like Zach Lowe's thing on Grantland about the Raptors and, you know, the sort of how you try to organize a defense correctly based on seeing where people move or where they let, you know, they didn't make the rotations as smartly as they should have. That stuff is continuing to happen. But in terms of like a new great leap forward into some kind of brand new way of understanding the game, I don't think that that's happening right now. I think that we're sort of in a trough of trying to learn a bunch of stuff and figure out how to apply it. You know, like one of the presentations was about recognizing ball screens using sport view data. It was the first thing I went to on the first day, and I walked out of it going like, that was the stupidest thing I have ever seen. Like, I was like, I have a machine that tells me if a ball screen was set. I have two of them. They're in my face. And I looked at it and I told, you know, it was, and it was, the problem was really the presentation was bad. Like the way the paper was presented was bad. I talked to people afterwards about the paper itself, and they helped me understand more why it made sense, which is sort of like if you're familiar with, you know, synergy sports.
Mm-hmm.
So synergy, you know, makes these categorizations, and then those categorizations are often incorrect, and they're based on people sitting in front of a video screen and labeling things that way. So this system was trying to take the coordinate data you get from sport view and say, you know, when players come together and then separate, is this a ball screen that's happening? And there's various ways to sort of measure if that happens or not. And they're trying to figure out the best sensitivity to get the most, to get as many as possible without getting plays that weren't, where somebody was just, they were just intersecting without setting screens. And so it's sort of a way to eliminate, like to get better data. So essentially you're not talking about like a new way, a new kind of data. It's just a better way to, a finer tooth comb to get the data. Like, does that tell us anything about ball screens yet? No. But it's sort of a step on the way to doing something else. And that was kind of the thing that just kept coming away from a lot of these presentations is we're sort of, you know, we sort of had this initial wave of things that looked cool. Now we're trying to dig into the data and really sort of start taking some of the stuff apart. So I feel like there's kind of this lull in analytics right now, which isn't a bad thing. It's just a natural thing that the initial explosion of information is giving way to sort of the hard work of parsing it all. But it was still a great weekend. It was a lot of fun. There's a lot of interesting presentations, and it's always nice to actually see in person all these people who you only talk to on Twitter or on the internet. So,
was there a team that was most talked about amongst writers there?
Sadly, the team that was talked the most about was the Knicks, and not in a positive way.
Oh, no.
So I felt really bad for my fellow writers. I was actually staying with Jim Cavan and Bob Silverman from Knickerblogger. And, you know, I'm friends with, you know, Jared Dubin and all these people who cover the Knicks. And they were just like so – like every time anything came up in, you know, in presentations, it was like, well, then if you look at the Knicks, like it's just it's terrible. So the Knicks was sort of used the most as like a negative correlation. You know, there was some interesting, there was a really interesting talk. I mean, the Rockets are always talked a lot about a lot because Morey is like the organizer of it. But there was an interesting discussion between Daryl Morey and Bob Myers from the Golden State Warriors about negotiations and how negotiations happen, which wasn't really, you know, it wasn't like analytic, but it was interesting to see them talk about how they made deals and how deals came together and sort of the, you know, the weird way these things happen and how players communicate with agents and agents communicate with organizations and different things along those lines. So the Warriors were pretty heavily represented. There was the basketball analytics panel had both Brad Stevens, who's the, you know, the coach of the Celtics, and Mike Zarin, who's the GM. So, you know, the Celtics also being in Boston were pretty heavily represented. But it was, I think all the teams are getting on board now, more or less. Some of them are more on board than others, but you know, I think that it's accepted that this is something that teams have to look at. They might all be using it in different ways, but yeah, it was a pretty good cross section of the NBA landscape.
Was there anybody representing the Thunder there?
I believe there was. I don't know who it was, only that I was talking with people who somebody was saying that like every team was represented except this team, and then it turned out that that person just was listed incorrectly in the brochure. So I think every NBA team had somebody there at least. Okay. Cool. I don't know who from the Thunder was there.
But. Okay. Well, I want to switch gears again, talk about the Suns. And I had a conversation with a friend yesterday. I don't really know what to think about the Suns. Like if they make the playoffs, like I don't know what to think about them and, you know, how to predict a series with them. Because, I know all these players, but they're winning games. And Goran Dragic is playing out of his mind. What do we do with this Suns team? And what do you think about, you know, their potential even, you know, in the first round of the playoffs?
Yeah, I think that they're of all the teams that are in the playoffs right now, I mean, I sort of think – I guess maybe Dallas is the most likely to fall out. Are they out or are they in right now?
I think they're in the eighth spot right now.
So. I think they're in the eighth spot now. I think they're the most likely to flag and fall out of the playoffs. But the Suns, a lot of people doubt the Suns just because they're playing so over their heads right now. They play really hard. I mean, having seen them live, you know, when they came and played the Wolves, I was at that game. Like, they just never stop working, you know, and that's huge, especially in the regular season. But I do think that might present a problem in the postseason in the sense that like hard work is necessary. I mean, teams that outwork other teams are going to be successful in the playoffs, so long as they also have talent. And I'm just not sure that the Suns' talent is deep enough to consistently back up that hard work when another team has time and familiarity with them. Mm-hmm. Because certain guys who have, like, you know, the Suns have worked very well, I think, on having, like, streaks of certain guys being great. I mean, Dragic has been great the whole season, more or less. But, like, Gerald Green can look great and then look terrible for a game or two. Mm-hmm. You know, he'll have like 4 games of 30 plus points or something in a row. And then he just, you know, he doesn't look as, I mean, his dunks always look great, but other than that, you know, I think they work so hard. I think that Miles Plumlee is really underrated as a center. He's so strong and he's so athletic. You don't see a lot of centers who really take it to Nikola Pekovic that hard. Even really athletic guys like DeAndre Jordan, who often have good games. I mean, Peck struggles against really athletic centers, but Plumlee is kind of athletic in the same kind of way as Peck. Like he's not a huge leaper, but he's just strong. Hmm. And then, you know, they've got great guys like Channing Frye who really space the floor. One of the Morris shoots threes better than the other. I can never remember which one is which, but
Marcus, I think.
I think it's Marcus who's a better three-point shooter. But it's like they're both good. What I was wondering out loud when I was watching them live is like, I feel like they should design plays around misunderstanding who you should be guarding, like Marcus, you know, that like that there should be more confusion of them suddenly switching places on the court or something, you know. I think that could really mess up, you know, opposing defenses. But yeah, I'm not really sure what to make of them either. I mean, I think that the hard work is in some ways seems more sustainable than. I mean, Portland also often works really hard, but I feel like they're more – they have that jump shooting label on them, which a lot of people feel like isn't going to work for very long in the playoffs. I could see the Suns – I mean, I could definitely see the Suns jumping on somebody out of the gate and getting an advantage that somebody else can't push back against because of that hard work and that ethic and how, you know, Jeff Hornacek just looks great in terms of coaching and getting those guys to execute. I mean, it's going to depend a lot on matchup, but I could see him making the second round maybe. Especially, yeah. Man, if we had 5-game series, which was something that was talked about at Sloan, they're like, you know, how to change things around with like single elimination tournaments. I mean, they're one of those things like there's a lot of talk about play-in tournaments for 8 seeds at Sloan or like some kind of single elimination tournament. Not that anybody was seriously talking about it, but just the fact of if you had a, you know, it's one of the reasons the Super Bowl is so huge. It's one game for, you know, for everything. You know, if the Suns, you're playing the Suns in a tournament in like in a win-or-go-home kind of tournament, you'd have to believe that they'd be one of those prime upset teams. The 7-game series is always tough. 5-game series, I might like them a lot better. So
yeah. Goran Dragic, this may be the dumbest thing in the whole world, and you can tell me if it is, but I was thinking, who would I rather have, Goran Dragic or James Harden? And I think it's James Harden easily, but I feel like that's more of a conversation this year. Dragic is shooting a better percentage. I mean, I know that Harden averages more points, but their games are pretty similar. And I really like what he's done. And to bring, I mean, he's the leader of the Suns team. I mean, it's undeniable seeing Bledsoe go out and watch him lead this team to several wins. And he doesn't have the team that James Harden has. What do you think about, you know, that comparison or that debate?
Yeah, I think part of the problem with Harden this year is that, he's been quietly good. I mean, he's had the problems he's always had with defense and things like that. I think a couple of things that happened early on in the year kind of had people not write Harden off, but just there was that sense last year that he was like ascendant, like he was an ascendant star. And then early this season, there's a couple really damning GIFs or video clips of him just not paying attention on defense. And then I think he just kind of slipped into the back of the conversation about, you know, about who's front running in the NBA. And maybe that's partly because of, you know, having Howard and how that conversation has gone. And I mean, I think as much as it's possible, it seems like the Rockets have flown a little under the radar this season. Whereas Dragic has got that story of being ascendant sort of this year, and it sort of came out of left field and has impressed everyone. I think the comparison isn't unfair. I sort of early on, I mean, not super early on, but when I was looking at, Rubio specifically and his layup difficulties, and I was trying to find like a comparable player where I could be like, this guy has a game kind of like Rubio's, but he finishes really well at the rim. Like, how can I look at both of them and see like what they do? And the guy I immediately jumped on was Dragic because he has a really high, he finishes really well at the rim. And then I started watching, tape of Dragic. And I was like, well, this guy is a lot better than Rubio. Like, I mean, like, just as an overall player. But, you know, in some ways, there's a similarity to their games, you know, to some extent, except that Dragic is much more accomplished in all those ways. And you see him, like, I watched a lot of him finishing at the rim, and he's so poised and so clearly in control, which is one of the big things that Rubio generally isn't when he's going to the basket. But, you know, Dragic has got that, great length. He's just kind of unassuming because he just looks like, my cousin. Like, that was what I realized the other night. I was like, you look a lot like my cousin Patrick. Like, he just doesn't look like he should be a terrifying NBA player, and yet he is. So, I really like his game. I like all the nicknames. You know, I like that they're calling him the Dragon, and I like the whole, you know, How to Train Your Dragic and Mother of Dragic and all that stuff like that. So he's got a good appealing. He has a brother named Zoran, which is also an appealing part of the whole equation to have a brother with a name that's very similar to yours. So, I really like him. I would take him in a heartbeat. So
yeah, definitely. So Kevin Love has been just out of his mind lately, and he's been playing really well. Does it kind of sting knowing that he could leave, or are you just enjoying it?
You know, the question of Love leaving or staying is always, it's always foremost in a lot of Wolves fans' minds. I feel like I spend so much time dealing with the Wolves that it's almost impossible for me to be like a straight fan of the team anymore, which is kind of sad in a way, because there was a time where I was really emotionally invested in the team. But it's like, if I were going to be really emotionally invested in the team, I would just be exhausted all the time because I spend so much time thinking about the team and dealing with the team that it's, I think it would just kill me to really have to deal with this stuff. So I try to be as analytical as possible. So right now I'm just enjoying his outburst, and I'm just impressed with, you know, the fact that, you know, his February was so amazing, and it was during a time when he was missing Peck and mostly missing Martin, when defense is really, he's the only offensive weapon on the floor for the Wolves, and yet he still put up these amazing numbers. I remember when Garnett left and went to the Celtics, you know, a lot of people were sore about it. Obviously, Garnett didn't leave on the best terms with the Wolves front office and everything like that. But I was really happy for his success in Boston. You know, I mean, when they won the championship, it was so exciting, and not just because, you know, Garnett sort of shouted out Minnesota when he did it, but just that it's great to see a great player get to a place that fits him so well. And that was the thing with Garnett, is that, you know, he'd been asked to do so much in Minnesota, and, you know, he led the team. He would, like, I'd have to go back to check, but I believe there's seasons in which he led them in points, blocks, rebounds, and assists, you know, like, which is ridiculous. And yet people kept being like, well, he can't finish games. He's not clutch. Can't provide the basket down the stretch. And then he goes to Boston, and you realize it's like the thing that's most amazing about him was his defense, you know, and his defensive acumen and the way he organized the floor on the defensive end to just get so much out of, like, a lot of Wolves teams that should be awful on defense, you know. That was what was impressive about him. So in some ways, if Love does end up leaving, I mean, my only hope is that he goes someplace where we suddenly realize that he has even more to offer than we ever thought. Hmm. You know, that he gets into a system where he's, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what that system would be, because in a lot of ways it seems like this system should have been ideal for him with Rubio. But, you know, I don't know if that means they need, like, with a dynamic wing score that opens things up for him both a little more down low and a little more on the perimeter. But all of a sudden, it's like not just that he's putting up great numbers, but that his success, his efficiency gets better, where he's not having to lift as much all the time. So, I mean, now I'll have trouble if he goes to the Lakers, because it's the Lakers. But actually, I mean, I kind of love the Lakers this season because they're so bananas, you know, so I would entirely hate it. But, you know, I remember I think Zach Lowe floated this idea of moving Westbrook to Minnesota essentially for Rubio and Pekovic. And that's interesting to me, in the sense that A, it would, you know, reunite Westbrook with Love, which is clearly something that's been sort of talked about as a thing he wants to do because they both went to UCLA. You know, it would give Minnesota like a really fun team to have Westbrook and Love on the, I think they would fit really well together.
Yeah.
And that would be fun. And then I kind of love the idea of like Rubio and then, you know, I guess Cephalosha slash Lamb slash, you know, sort of a defensive shooting guard and then an off shooting guard. And then Durant and Love. No, it's Durant and Ibaka and Pekovic, I think would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think anybody's going to do that, but it is kind of one of those things when Zach floated it, I was like, I mean, I know it doesn't make a lot of sense in the micro for a lot of those things, but just as a basketball fan, I would like to see those two configurations happen. So, you know, I don't know. I try not to be too emotionally attached, I guess, to the bottom line. And I want Love to go to be able to realize himself as a player, and whether that's in Minnesota or somewhere else, like, I just want to get to watch it as a fan of basketball as opposed to being a fan of a team. So
what do you think about a Serge Ibaka, 3 first round picks, Jeremy Lamb for Kevin Love?
I like that. I think I floated something similar to that at one point on Twitter. I think that could be really compelling as well. I mean, I think the idea of pairing Ibaka and Pekovic together in either situation is a nice front court pairing, because you get a sort of good offensive center who's good on defense but not a rim protector. Because I think Pekovic has become good on defense, especially in terms of schemes that involve dropping on the pick and roll. You know, like he's not going to stop shots. He's not going to hop out and stop penetration. But he's really good. He's really smart about keeping the offensive player in front of him. And he's got a big body. So he's competent on defense, but not a rim protector. And then he's very good offensively down low, along with somebody who's like Ibaka has a mid-range game. You know, I mean, it's not LaMarcus Aldridge, but, you know, he's got a good mid-range game, and then he's great defensively and active, you know, in terms of being a rim protector. I like that pairing a lot. So, and plus I think Rubio and Ibaka would be a lot of fun together on pick and rolls, and then you can also have pick and pops with them. So I like that idea.
And the Thunder would score like 130 points a game.
I know. I mean, and it's really one of those things where I think that Love, I mean, given that Love's shooting, like, I don't think it's one of those problems where you'd be like, there's not enough basketballs. You know, I think that both Durant and Love are very efficient as scorers. So you've got one guy, Westbrook, who's not as efficient, but the other two guys are going to be so efficient for you. Like, Love doesn't take a lot of bad shots. I mean, his worst shots are probably the ones where he's kind of between close range and mid range, or if he's close and then he kind of does the fadeaway hook, which I think he's often looking for, or he's looking for contact in some of those situations and he doesn't get it. So, but generally when he's taking threes, it's because he's open, you know, like he's not going to take a lot of threes under pressure, and then he's going to finish at the rim on offensive rebounds and things like that. So yeah, that would be a fun Thunder team as well. Definitely. I just like fun basketball. So,
so Ricky Rubio, everyone talks about him being like the worst shooter ever. And, you know, the national media is really down on him. And I don't, what do the local fan base think about Ricky Rubio? What's the general opinion in Minnesota on him?
I think it's more positive generally than the national perspective still, in the sense that, I think if I could characterize the national reaction, like a sort of casual fan reaction, it's that Rubio came into the league so hyped and then, like did some amazing things his rookie year. And then people kind of checked out. And then they check back in and they're like, oh, he can't shoot. And that's all they know. And there's not any sort of emotional attachment to it or anything like that. But, you know, because I see people who are like, oh, he's a backup point guard at best, you know. And to me, it's like, yeah, he has trouble shooting. First of all, he actually, like, I ran the numbers the other day, but like in, I think December, he had a terrible December. He had an awful December. Like November and December, I think he shot like 38%. Within 5 feet of the rim. But in January and February, he shot like 47 or 48% from within 5 feet. So like, it's actually, I think that December was so bad that that's what is sticking in everybody's mind. I mean, that doesn't mean that he's a good shooter, but I don't think he has to be a great shooter. I mean, he tied the franchise record for assists in a game with 17, like a couple weeks ago. And that was his career high. He's leading the league in steals. You know, I just don't think that, I mean, I think he's a weird player, and I think people don't know what to do with him, but I don't think that means that he's just like a bench point guard. Like, I think he can be an effective starting point guard. Within Minnesota, I mean, I think there's still affection for him. He's a likable guy. I don't know if there's quite the affection that, I mean, I think it's less affection than there was last season. I think there's a little bit of impatience with him to turn into something really, really great. I think the idea that Khan was holding off that 5-year max contract for Rubio looks ludicrous right now. But there's ways in which that can benefit Minnesota. I mean, in the sense that if you're looking at Rubio, depending on what happens next year, if you're looking at like re-signing Rubio, he's clearly not a max player, which gives you more room to sign other people. Like if Rubio's camp's stance is give us a max or we're going, then you let him go because he's not worth a max. But if you're talking about giving him, you know, 8, 9, 10 million a year, that's not so bad. Mm-hmm. And then if he actually continues to improve, which I think he will since he's only 23, I think, you know, he could be a really good point guard for that, you know, 9 million a year. You know, he's really like, and I think people are going to like him, you know, and I think his teammates like him. But there's legitimate questions about, you know, is he a fit for every team, which I don't think he is. You know, I wouldn't be terrible if he was traded, I guess, or if he goes somewhere else. But I like having him around. I mean, he's a lot of fun to watch play, and he's always going to do fun things. And I think he's getting back a little bit more to playing a little bit looser in the last, you know, month or so, which is good to see because I think that makes the game fun for the people around him. So
yeah, I've always been a big Rubio fan. I wanted him badly in Oklahoma City when they picked James Harden instead of him. But I'm glad that he's not as bad as everyone talks about because I don't get to watch him. I've probably seen him play like 2 or 3 times this season. But that's good to know that he's not quite as terrible as everyone thinks that he is.
Yeah, I think it's just an overreaction. It's like it was weird to see. It's weird to see him like labeled as overrated because I'm like, who doesn't know that he's not. Like, overrated would mean that you think he's amazing. And I don't think he's – I mean, I think individual elements of him and his game are amazing. But overall, I'm like, I'm not going to – he's not a top 10 point guard. Like, I know that, you know. So it's weird to see people calling him overrated because maybe that's just because within the market here, we kind of know that I think we have a pretty good sense of who he is. I don't think he's really underrated or overrated, at least by Timberwolves fans. I think we think he can be a starting point guard and a good contributor on this team without having to be like a top 10 point guard. You know, it feels like everybody feels like they have to have a top 10 point guard. I'm like, there's only 10 of them and there's 30 teams.
Yeah.
You know, like there's some certain math things that I feel like people fall back on, you know, like the entire league as a whole, every season is 500, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you add up all the wins and all the losses for all the teams, they equal the same number. So some teams are going to be below 500 and some are going to be above 500. Like you can't have every team above 500. It just doesn't literally work. So, the whole thing of like, you know, there was the thing that was on ESPN with people talking to scouts. I think it was Chris Broussard talked to scouts, and some of them just had things where they were saying like Rondo he's not even a top 40 point guard.
Yeah.
So you would take 29. I mean, given that Rondo is a starting point guard, you would take 29, the other 29 starting point guards, including like Raymond Felton, and then 11 backups before you pick, you know, Rondo. Like that seems kind of ludicrous to me. So sometimes people just throw out these things about this is top 10, this is top 15. Like you really have to think about like who are those people before you make statements like that. Like if you're going to pick 10 people over Rubio, who are those people? If you're going to pick 15 over Rubio, who are those people? So, I mean, I still like Rubio. He's still cute. So you can't discount that. You know, that's an intangible. So.
So if you were the GM of this Wolves team, what would you do going forward?
Oh man, that's, That's so tough. I feel like it depends so much on stuff that's completely unknowable at this moment, probably to even the Wolves, even Flip Saunders, and even maybe Kevin Love. I mean, I think that, you know, the Wolves have won 6 of their last 7 right now. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, still on outside of the playoffs, but it's possible. I mean, and I'm looking at their schedule coming up and I'm like, well, they got the Knicks, they got the Kings again, they got the Bobcats, you know, like there's a lot of teams they could take it to. You know, Love is probably looking to put up 60 or more against the Bobcats at this point, given Anthony and James recently. So, you know, I think there's been sort of a debate going on Twitter I saw this morning about like whether it's better for Love to make the playoffs this season in terms of selling him on the team, or if it's better at this point if they don't make the playoffs and they get a pick that could actually help them next year. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot depends on what happens through the end of this season. I sort of feel like if they make a good push, even if they don't make the playoffs, which they're making a good push right now, I think that ups the case for keeping Love. If they don't, I mean, I would try to look for trading Love before the trade deadline, mostly just because I don't want to lose him for nothing, which I kind of hate that construction sometimes. But honestly, I feel like his value has got to be at a real high right now. So you just try to get as much as you can. I'm not against rebuilding, you know, and trying to get a good pick out of moving Love. I don't know who the suitors would be for Love, who could offer something that would be worth it in terms of picks. I think it really all hinges on what happens down the stretch of the season right now and how Love reacts to that, which involves, you know, obviously having a relationship with Love and knowing what he thinks about it. Because I could see them making the playoffs and looking better and looking good next season and him still opting out, you mm-hmm. know. I can't really see them doing – I can see him missing the playoffs and doing badly next year and certainly him opting out. I can't see him staying if that's the case. I could also see this – like David Thorpe, I don't know if you saw this. David Thorpe had a great thing with True Hoop TV where he talked about Love and his position right now. And Thorpe was pretty sanguine on the Wolves' chances next year, even if nothing changes. You know, that like they haven't had a ton of injuries this season, but a lot of weird things happened that have made them, you know, whatever it is, like 2-16 for games within 5 points or less or mm-hmm. something like that. That even if you just ride this out, like they might be really good next season, even if there's not a lot of change to the roster, which I think is very possible. And it, you know, Love is at least saying the right things right now. He seems less sort of cranky than he has been recently. I think you got to see what happens down the stretch and then talk to Love and see what he thinks about that mm-hmm. and then make your decisions based off that. I think so it's a good sign that Flip and he are having regular conversations, I think, is the most important thing. So
that's good. That's a tough situation in Minnesota because yeah. they were supposed to, I mean, they could have been really good and their point differential, you know, says that they're not this bad, but right. It's a tough situation in Minnesota.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, it was like you could lay it on the feet of injuries the last couple seasons. But, you know, to me, the interesting thing is what's going to happen with Adelman, because mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know that he wants to coach another year, it seems like. And I can see they have some of the architecture in place to say if Adelman wants to step aside, like not be fired, like Sorry, you still there?
Yeah.
My phone was just going nuts for some reason. That's so, okay. So if Adelman wants to step aside, they've got Saunders there as the GM. They don't have to go through a coaching search. I would, and I'm not saying I advocate this or anything like that, but I think Saunders would be like, I would step in as coach, you know, for a season while they start working on finding somebody. And then that puts you in the position of hiring somebody new when you know whether Love is going to be there or not, you know?
Yeah.
That way you've got Saunders as an interim who's not expecting to get, you know, he could be an interim for a season or until they find the person that they want to get and then go back to being GM. I mean, I don't know about the psychodynamics of that. I don't know what Saunders' goal is, but, you know, he's got an ownership stake in the team at this point. So in some ways they're prepared to deal with it if it happens. I sort of feel like and not in a condemning way, but it just seems like Adelman was brought on, you know, 3 years ago to sort of take this team to the next step immediately. And then injuries really prevented that for the last 2 years. And then this season, it's been so demoralizing. He's 67, you know, like that's, that's pretty old.
Yeah.
If you're not in a situation that's already successful, like if you're not talking about Popovich or somebody like that, like, I don't know how long you want to stick around.
Getting on a plane 41 times a year. That's tough. Yeah.
He's got his wife's health to worry about as well in terms of the travel schedule, in addition to a ridiculous travel schedule. So I wouldn't hold it against him if he decided he wanted to step aside. So
yeah. Well, Steve, thanks for coming on the podcast today. We'll read your stuff on Grantland and everywhere else on the internet. We appreciate your time, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Andrew.